we're doing with that. John's good news, true witnesses, so that you will believe. True witnesses to Christ, so that you will believe. And am I... that on? Okay. I just wanted to make sure I stepped away from it. So when I lead singing, I'm on this mic. And then when I preach, I'm on this mic. No. I'm on this mic. I'm always on this mic. So you can always hear that. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure I had clicked the right button. So we saw last week the first three trials with the religious authorities. And I just want to point out to you, as we looked at those religious trials, they were getting him, they wanted to find out if he was stirring up an underground secret sect to overthrow the Roman government, because that's what they're going to accuse him of. The Roman government doesn't care if Jesus claims to be God. They really don't care. It's of none of that. You can claim to be God all you want. The Roman government, they have to get him on something because they want him to hang on a tree. They want him to be crucified as a traitor. They want to destroy his disciples. They want to destroy this group that threatens their power. So their inquisition of him was to try to find out about his doctrine and his disciples, remember? So the disciples is, you have an underground sect. The doctrine is, we want you to incriminate yourself that you are blaspheming by calling yourself God. Okay? So you have to understand their two-pronged attack. So what I want to do today is I'm going to give you some more geography. Are you ready? So this, in your lower right-hand corner, to get the people by scale, this is a model that is built in Jerusalem of Jerusalem at the time of Christ. So you can see to scale, here's a lady and there's the temple. She's not as tall as the temple was, okay? The temple was over 60 feet tall, and she's a very sweet lady, and she's barely over 5 foot. So it's to scale, but this is Jerusalem. Right here is likely where Pentecost took place on these steps. These are the mikvahs, where probably the first baptisms on the day of Pentecost took place. That's where you would ceremonially clean yourself, wash yourself by immersing yourself in water, then come up these steps. And this is the courtyard. This is where Jesus did a lot of his teaching. This is Antonio's fortress, a Roman garrison. This is likely where Jesus is interrogated by Pilate. That is likely. One of the sites for Calvary is literally right here. It's no more than 200 or 300 yards from Antonio's fortress. There's another possible site that's over this way that's only a few hundred more yards. So it's very, very, very close by. So, taking you to this map, this lady, if you're looking at that, she is standing, if you're looking at the map on the model, she's standing about right there. Okay, so they've come back to Caiaphas' house, and Caiaphas is about to send him to Pilate. Remember, he's gone from Caiaphas to Annas and back to Caiaphas, and they're probably all staying in the same adjoining rooms for Passover. This distance, whoops, went too far. This distance from Caiaphas' house to the temple is maybe 700 or 800 yards. It's not that far. So if you stop and think, 700, 800 meters, no more than that, it's maybe a 10-minute walk at the most. Okay? So they're going to take him most likely to Antonio's fortress right there. It's right here on this map. They're going to take him from over here. They're going to wander him through these streets, and then take him to Pilate, who's probably here at Antonio's fortress, named after Mark and Antonio. Okay, Marcus Antonius, the Roman leader. So I'm going to give you the model from a different direction. The direction that you saw here is, you are looking at it. She is actually standing on the Mount of Olives, if you do it to scale. Down here would be the Kidron Valley. Right below her feet would be the Garden of Gethsemane, if that was to scale, okay? So now you're looking at Jerusalem facing west. You're east of Jerusalem. The next, let me go forward. Nope, let me go. Nope, wrong way, Mike. Okay, really wrong way. I don't handle technology well. Let me keep going. Now we're going to get there. Okay, so this, she was standing right here on this model right here, she was standing just off. So now we're looking at it from the south. We're looking at Jerusalem from the south. This little bit right here, that was David's Jerusalem. 15 acres. 15 acres. That's all the size of David's Jerusalem. The spring where the man goes and washes his eyes, it's right here. We will take our group. This is David's house right up here. Bathsheba's house was probably right down here. And you look down over the cliff line. This is the Kidron Valley, and this is the Hinnom Valley. This is hell right down here where they took the garbage. This spring is where the man would have gone and cleansed his eyes. And these steps right there are actually uncovered now in their first century steps. The spring is first century. Hezekiah built a tunnel underneath this to the spring when Sennacherib the Assyrian was coming, and we can walk through that spring, that tunnel underneath that has water in it to this day, and we'll do that when we get to Jerusalem. David and Solomon's house was here. This is the temple, and that's where the death angel stood on Araunah, and when David had counted the people, David looked up from his house and he saw the death angel, and he came up and he did the sacrifice there and bought that land. And that's, so this is Mount Zion. You can see, remember I told you the lower city is here and the upper city, do you see the valley that runs through here? That's the valley. It's known as the Cheesemaker Valley. So this is called Lower Jerusalem, and this was the upper city. The richer people lived here, the poor people lived here. And this is the temple area, and there's Antonio's fortress. Now we're switching a little bit almost to the west, and this would be the area of Caiaphas' house right in here. Okay? So you can kind of get an idea when Caiaphas takes Jesus, when Jesus is in the upper room, which is about here, and he goes across, and he goes over to where these folks are. That's the Garden of Gethsemane. They arrest him. They come down this way, come through the gate, bring him to Caiaphas' house. Caiaphas and Annas talk to him. Then, as the dawn is coming, 6 a.m., they take him to Herod's palace. And over in this part of the city is, they take him to Pilate. And then this part of the city is Herod. So they're going to go back and forth. Today, we're going to be first with Pilate, then to Herod, then back to Pilate, and then outside the city wall to Calvary. Okay, that's the walking from Good Friday through to the death of Christ, or Thursday night to the death of Christ. Okay. I just want to put that in your head a little bit so you can at least feel a little bit of what Jesus is going through as he gets to these civil trials. So remember I mentioned to you last week there's six trials. John mentions three of them. John mentions a religious trial and two civil trials. We're going to go to Luke for the one before Herod, because John leaves that one out. It's not in his theme. So he's going to leave that one out. So probably what we're going to do today is we're going to look at the first trial before Pilate and then the second trial before Herod. And we'll pick up the last trial of Pilate later because it's just so much longer. John gives us way more information about these trials than anybody else. And it may be because John followed with the chief priest, that John was present. Remember, after Peter is rebuked by the rooster, right? He's rebuked by the rooster. John is the one that lets him in, most likely. We saw that last week. John is at the cross. It's not unreasonable to think that John the Apostle, that is writing this story for us, he was at the Last Supper. He laid his head on Christ's breast. He went to the Garden of Gethsemane. He fell asleep. And Jesus came twice and said, "Wake up." That he was known because of his relationship to the priests through his aunt, who was John the Baptist's mother, and her husband was a priest, that he gets into Caiaphas and Annas' apartment complex. That then, when they take Jesus to Pilate, he follows behind and goes to that, and he's there, not for the interrogation privately, but for the external. And then after he's condemned to death, that John follows him to the cross, because we know John is at the cross. Because Jesus in the afternoon is going to say, "John, your mom, mom, John, your son." So it's not impossible for us to believe that the witness account that we're seeing from John is literally he is at these scenes. And as an old man in his 80s and in his 90s, he's now writing back after the Gospels are all finished. He's 25 years later, and he says, I'm the last remaining apostle that's alive. Let me tell you from an eyewitness account so that you can believe in Jesus. So these are the trials that we will look at two of them today. So if you're taking notes with me, Christ's first civil trial. So they're going to take him from Caiaphas. I showed you that route. It's probably no more than a 10 to 15 minute walk. So as the sun is coming up, the Gospels tell us, 6 a.m.-ish in the morning, as the sun is coming up, they are going to take Jesus on a 10 or 15 minute walk. How would you like to be the Roman leader who could have been down at Caesarea, where the Romans on the coast with the cool sea breeze, and now you got to become up amongst all these Jews? It's Passover, there's Barabbas, there's revolt, they're unruly, and now you're awakened by a runner coming to you at 5:45 in the morning. Hey, there's going to be a trial. The Jews need to see you. There's someone claiming to be Caesar. How many of you would like to be Pilate to be awakened like that at 6 o'clock in the morning before you had your coffee? I would not. How many of you don't want anybody to talk to you before 9 o'clock in the morning? That should be a better question. Boy, your wife just narked you out just like that. She was like pointing right at you. So, roughly 6 o'clock in the morning, Pilate's ready to receive Jesus. Some people have debated, can you get across the city? Yes, you can. And all they had to do was send a messenger to Pilate, we're coming. So then they took Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium. We're not sure that it has to be Antonio's fortress, but we think it is. He could have been staying in the same vicinity as King Herod, but unlikely, because we read in the text that Pilate and Herod weren't friends until after they had both condemned Jesus to die, right? So probably it's Antonio's fortress. He would have several hundred Roman soldiers. It was Passover. That meant the over 100,000 Jews. They're always thinking about revolt. They're always thinking, so he's going to stay with, he's not going to be walking the streets because where he could get stabbed by some zealot. He's most likely in Antonio's fortress. And it was early morning. But notice they themselves did not go into the Praetorium lest they should be defiled. It's Passover. They are ceremonially clean. If they are around a Gentile, if they get close to a Gentile, then they can't partake in Passover. Think of the hypocrisy here. They are about to condemn an innocent man, but they can't be even close to a Gentile. So Pilate went out to them, I'm probably completely annoyed with their customs, and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? He comes out and he says, what do you get me up at 5:30 on Friday morning? What kind of an accusation are you bringing against this man? So I'm going to give you a bunch of subpoints here so you can get ready to write. So the hypocritical Jews keep a ritual law, but propose to murder an innocent man. The hypocritical Jews, if you're taking notes with me, this is A. The hypocritical Jews keep a ritual law. Oh, we can't be around a Gentile, but propose to murder a completely innocent man. So they let him, and he says, what accusation do you bring? And they answered and said to him, if he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. They're kind of sarcastic. I mean, does it matter? We're like the head honcho Jews around here, and this is Passover, and we got 153,000 Jews out here, and you really want to... Pilate, what are you doing? We wouldn't have, if he wasn't an evildoer, we would not have bothered you. Sometimes, you know, we can be hypocritical. The word hypocrite comes from the Greek word hypokritos. Hypokritos was the mask that a Greek drama individual would wear. The early days of Greek drama, they would have three or four people that were a traveling troupe of doing a drama, and often the drama would have 8, 9, 10 characters. You wouldn't know who the character was if they didn't wear, they would hold up a mask. So they would hold up a mask, and this character had that mask, and a different character had a different, So the same actor could play three or four different parts depending on the scene and which mask, and you had to follow along which mask was which character, even though it was the same voice and the same person. The mask was known as Hippocrates. The mask was Hippocrates. In other words, they wore a mask. They were somebody at church, and they were somebody else at home, and they were somebody else with their kids, and they were somebody else at work, and they were somebody else, and they were somebody else, and it was the same person. But depending on where they were, they just created hypocrisy. They wore a completely different mask depending on where they were. That's why when the Bible says, let love be without, the old King James word is dissimulation, it really means let love be without hypocrisy. The word for hypocrisy is used. Don't let your love be a mask for something else. Don't pretend to love somebody and, you know, especially if you're from the South, you know what I'm about to say. Oh, bless their heart. Somebody said one time to me, and my mom always says, bless their heart. You know, you just bless their heart. They didn't have my parents or whatever, you know, that kind of a thing. And my mom always used to say, when you say bless your heart, that's your excuse so you can say whatever else you want to say about them, right? And that's not good. That's not me telling you to do that. That's me telling you, we tend to be hypocrites. We tend to have hypocrisy. These people, the Jews, were keeping a minute ritual law, and they were about to break love God, love your neighbor as yourself. They were about to commit murder and advocate for murder and demand murder on a completely innocent person. So about the time we castigate them, let's not miss the fact that we can be hypocrites too. But notice number two or B, if you're taking notes with me, the hypocritical Jews are admonished by a Gentile leader. I think this is hilarious. The hypocritical Jews are admonished by a Gentile leader. So think of the story so far. You've had a rooster scold Peter. And now you have a pagan, Pilate, Roman ruler scolding the PhDs in Jewish religiosity. And I always say, if God can use a donkey to scold Balaam, and he can use a rooster to scold Peter, and he can use a pagan leader to scold the Pharisees, you know what? We ought to be open. Don't be a hypocrite, or God may send a coworker that doesn't even know Jesus to call you out. Then Pilate said to them, you take him. You take him and judge him according to your law. Don't get me up in the morning. I haven't had my coffee. What are you doing? He's a snarky back to them. Honestly, everybody in this scene needed Starbucks. That's just, everybody here needed Dunkin' Donuts. I don't know what, but man, they are just not happy with each other at 6 o'clock on Good Friday morning. Do they not know it's Good Friday, right? So Pilate's kind of snarky right back. You take him and you judge him according to your law. Well, they didn't want to just stone him. And technically, the Jews weren't allowed to kill, but they did it anyway. We know they did it with Stephen. We know from history that they did burn some women who they accused of adultery. We know that from history, even after the Romans came. So they weren't technically supposed to be able to kill, but it didn't stop them with Stephen. It didn't stop them in other cases. But they didn't want to just stone him. And isn't it interesting? If they had stoned him, it would have broken his bones. And the prophecy was that not a bone on him would be broken. They don't want to just have him die. They are so angry at how he's shown them up. Every confrontation, every single time, this Galilean peasant who claims to be God, how dare he? Every time they get into a discussion with him, he reveals what hypocrites they are. And the people are now, instead of honoring them, are starting to look at them as like, wait a second, maybe they are ripping us off. They don't want him to just die. They want to humiliate him. They want to squash him. They hate him. So Pilate says to them, you take him. You do whatever you want. See, if you're taking notes with me, the hypocritical Jews want Christ murdered as a traitor to Rome. I've already alluded to this, but the hypocritical Jews, they want Christ murdered as a traitor to Rome. They don't want Him stoned. Now, they don't know in not stoning Him, because what was the Old Testament law for blasphemy? What was the death supposed to be? Yeah. That's what they're going to do to Stephen in a few weeks, right? In a few months? They're going to say, you're blaspheming. You say that you see the Son of God. You don't see this. And they stone Him. They carry out the Old Testament law. What was the proper thing if it was truly you blaspheme what Caiaphas says to him at the last trial? You're a blasphemer. They should have taken Him out and stoned Him. So they were breaking the Jewish law at several places. Why? Because they hated Him. They wanted Him crucified, and they did not know they were fulfilling multiple Old Testament scriptures. You go to Psalm 22 and you read Psalm 22, and here is a passage written 300 years at least before the Assyrians invent crucifixion. David is penning it, and David writes clearly about a crucifixion. You read about not a bone of Him would be broken. Very, very rarely could you have a stoning without multiple bones being broken. So they are actually, in their hatred, they're fulfilling all of God's prophecies. Let me just clue us in on something. You may work with somebody that hates you. I was going to say you might be married to somebody that hates you, but hopefully that's not true. I'm joking. You know, maybe your adult children don't appreciate you. Maybe you have an older mom or a dad that never cared for you. Maybe they're not even in your life. Maybe you never knew them. Do you understand that no matter how much somebody that you would love despises you, God's purpose for your life can never be violated and stopped? These religious leaders hated Jesus. And yet God's purpose for Jesus was fulfilled through their hatred. As Joseph said 2,000 years before to his brothers, you meant it for evil, but God, finish it with me, meant it for good. One of the greatest encouragements I have in my life, as far as a believer, is no matter what evil anybody intends for me, God's purpose that I will become like Jesus, that I will be sanctified, that I will be holy, that's God's purpose. And Romans 8:28 says that all things work together for good to them who love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. The next, we quote that one all the time, because that's a great verse. Please don't deny. The next verse, I think, is even better. Because it says purpose in verse 28, and verse 29 says, what is God's purpose? Verse 29, that we would be conformed to the image of His dear Son. Verse 29 is actually better than verse 28. Because verse 29 defines the word good and the word purpose in Romans 8. What is good is anything that conforms me to the image of Jesus Christ. What is bad is anything that takes me away from the image of Jesus Christ. So sometimes we'll talk to people, how are you doing, Dale? I'm doing good. What do we mean? Well, let's say I didn't get hit on the way I was driving on the 470 and I miraculously survived. So, I mean, that's good. It's a good day. I had a cup of coffee. That's a good day. What's a bad day? Oh, my wife isn't feeling good. My grandkids aren't feeling good. My kids aren't feeling good. The days I got a lot to do today, it's a bad day. Do you know that there are no bad days to a Christian? Because once you're saved, once you're in Jesus Christ, every day is a good day because God's eternal purpose will not be flustered by discomfort that people bring into your life. He will work everything out to conform you to the image of God's dear Son, to change you to be like Jesus. And since that's the definition of good, there can never, ever, ever, ever be a bad day for a believer. Now, there are uncomfortable days. There are sad days. There are days we go through loss. There are days we go through hurt. There are days we go through physical, emotional, spiritual pain. But all of those days, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, those are all good days by the Bible. Because God will only use all the circumstances. Look at how Good Friday was. I'm using it as a pun, but truly how good Good Friday was for us and for the world, and how uncomfortable it was for Jesus. And God used the wrath of men, these men that hated Jesus at every level. God used their wrath to accomplish one prophecy being fulfilled after another after another. In your life, God will use people that despise you, people that don't appreciate you, people that don't care for you. God will use them in your life as you cooperate with the Holy Spirit, as you yield to the Spirit of God. God will use them in your life to conform you to the image of Jesus Christ. Listen to me. You are never more like Jesus than when you are unjustly treated and you respond biblically. Let me say it again. You are never more like Jesus than when you are treated unjustly, but you respond biblically. Isn't that what our Savior did? When He was reviled, what does Peter say? What did He do? He reviled not. These hypocritical Jews want Christ murdered as a traitor to Rome, and in their hatred and in their desire to squash Christianity, they actually are God's vehicle for His glory. Because without the cross, we would never see the full essence of God. We would never see perfect forgiveness. We would never see perfect mercy. We would never see perfect love. We would never see perfect holiness. Without the cross, we would never see all the perfect characteristics of Jesus Christ and God Himself without the cross. They are going to, in their hatred, accomplish God's purpose. Notice D, Christ answers Pilate's question. D, if you're taking notes with me, Christ answers Pilate's questions. So then Pilate entered the praetorium. He comes into the area where the questioning will take place. The chief priests are outside. They won't come in. But Jesus is with him in private. And he says to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Christ answers Pilate's questions. And they began to accuse him. So from a distance, they're going to accuse him because they're staying away from Pilate. They're at a distance. They start accusing him, saying, "We found this fellow." I'm in Luke. I'm sorry. I skipped ahead because I want to give you Luke's rendition of this scene. Luke's rendition in Luke 23:2. "And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes, and saying that he is Christ a king.'" So question, did they say there he's blaspheming, calling himself God? Remember, that's what Caiaphas got mad at him. You remember that last week? When Caiaphas says, "Oh, do we have any other need?" He admits he claims to be God. He's worthy of death. Now they change their accusation. That's why I stuck Luke 23 in here. Notice the three items. They say he is perverting the nation. In other words, they're accusing him of sedition. They're saying that he is perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes. So he's setting up his own financial kingdom so he can be a king and raise an army. And number three, they say that he himself is a king, that he has his own kingdom. So they make three accusations in Luke 23:2, and then Jesus is going to answer those. Are you accusing me of sedition? If you're taking notes, that's the number one here. So Jesus is basically saying to him, I'm back in John now, are you accusing me of sedition? So I skipped over to Luke so you could see the, because John's comments don't make, Jesus' comments in John don't make as much sense if you don't understand what the Pharisees and they were accusing him of. Okay? So Jesus is saying, are you accusing me of sedition? Then Pilate entered the praetorium and said, are you the King of the Jews? Are you accusing me of being a traitor? Are you accusing me of sedition? Are you accusing me of trying to overthrow the Roman government? He's saying to them. And Jesus answered him saying, are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me? In other words, he wants to know, Are the Pharisees filling your mind? Are the Jews filling your mind and telling you that I'm claiming to be a seditious person? Or do you think that yourself? He wants to get a little deeper. Pilate, of course, is going to be shocked. Like, who in the world are you? You're a Galilean peasant, and you're in here talking to the Roman leader. Like, what do you mean questioning me? I question you, Bubba. But Jesus' answer is rebutting. Do you know that I'm guilty of sedition? Do you have any evidence that I'm guilty of treason? Have you ever heard me advocate not paying taxes? Which, of course, Jesus advocated paying taxes, right? He said, look at the coin. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's, give to God what's God, right? Jesus never said, don't pay taxes. I wish he would have. But Jesus never said, don't pay taxes. No, I didn't say that. I'll be thrown in jail and they'll never see me again. So anyway, are you accusing me of being a traitor? Are you accusing me of sedition? But notice number two, my kingdom is not physical but spiritual. If you're taking notes, my kingdom is not physical but spiritual. Oh, so the three accusations are subverting the nation, opposing payment of taxes to Rome, and claiming to be Christ the King. Jesus is now in John going to answer those. Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done? In other words, look, I don't know anything. I don't know anything about you. I don't know about your doctrine or your disciples. What do you mean? I don't know anything about you, and it's 6:15 in the morning. I'm not even supposed to have this conversation yet. Jesus answered and said, oh, now here's his answer. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were... So he's starting to witness. Just think about this. Nicodemus, he talks about the new birth, and as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, because Nicodemus was what? A theologian. And he refers him to the Old Testament. He gets the woman at the well and he talks about water. She's at a well, right? He's there in the season of Hanukkah and he talks about, I am the light of the world with all the lights lit up. Now he's talking to Pilate, who was a senior officer in the greatest kingdom the world had ever seen. And what does he talk about? A kingdom. And he says to him, my kingdom is not... In other words, Jesus was great at going to where they were and what they were thinking and then bringing that thought, kingdom, to spiritual life. The birth of a child to the new birth, being born again. Water at a well to being the water of spirit, filling you with purpose for the rest of your life. Jesus was a master at taking what they were thinking about and translating it into where he could present himself. Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. He says, my kingdom is not physical, but spiritual. And then notice, thirdly, if you're taking notes with me, he says, my kingdom is truth. I love this. I love how he closes this out. He says, my kingdom is truth. Is this not what John had him saying in John 14:6? I am the way, what? The truth, the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. I am the door. And nobody goes in and out. You have to come to me. I am ultimate truth. I never lie. Satan is the father of lies. I am ultimate truth. It's one reason truth-telling to me is so important, because Jesus Christ himself says, I am truth. Being truthful is so vital. I am truth. Because if you aren't honest, you can't have a real relationship. You can't have real relationships with people that lie. You can't. Because you never know when they're lying. And that's exactly right. Sometimes people lie so much, they don't even know when they're lying. He said, my kingdom is truth. Wouldn't it be great if Washington, D.C. was built on truth? I vote yes. I vote. I think, wouldn't it be great if our media was built on truth? Wouldn't it be great if all of our marriages in America were built on truth? Wouldn't it be great if all of our jobs were built on truth? Pilate therefore says to him, "Are you a king then?" And Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness." Oh, there's John's word, right, Marturion? "That I should bear witness to the truth. My kingdom is truth. My kingdom, Satan's kingdom, is darkness and lies. And my kingdom is light and truth." And everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. So in other words, those guys out there that are accusing me, they're not of truth. He's calling them all what? Liars. Because if they were of truth, they would hear my voice. Do you realize that we should not in our lives mimic those who don't hear Christ's voice by lying? The very first cornerstone of being a Christian is we should always, always, always be a truthful people at work, in our marriages, with our children. In every facet of life, we should be of all people truthful. And Pilate looks at him and says, "What is truth?" A lot of ink has been spilt over whether this was sarcastic, whether this was cynical. Yeah, I've been in government a long time. I tell you what, you spend more than about 6 weeks in Washington, D.C., and you become a cynic really quickly. I spent 2 years there, and I walked out of there going, "Oh my goodness, no wonder we are in a mess." Is it cynical? Is it sarcastic? Like, there's thousands of gods. Which one is the truth? This is a great quote. I never have very many of them, but every once in a while I come up with one I really like. And this is a me quote. My wife has way more thoughtful quotes than me. This answers three philosophical questions that every human has. Where did I come from? What am I doing here? And where am I going? Where did I come from? What am I doing here? And where am I going? And this is truth. See, Jesus is a greater philosopher than Plato. Jesus is a greater philosopher than Socrates, than Confucius, than the Buddha, than Karl Marx, than Charles Darwin. And Darwin was a philosopher. Because Jesus can tell you where you came from, why are you here, and where are you going. And Confucius is dead. Buddha is dead. Muhammad is dead. Marx is dead. Darwin is dead. Jesus is alive. So I am created in the image of God. That's where I come from. That's why the tragedy of Ukraine today is such a tragedy. Because image bearers, their lives are being taken out on both sides of the conflict. When Jesus says, "Where do wars come from?" you, as he inspired James, they come from inside of you. You lust and you want to have and you desire to have and you want more. So Putin wants more land. He wants this. He wants to be remembered. He wants an image. He wants to put statues back up. He wants to recapture glory from the past. And he's willing to kill image bearers of God to do it. That's why what our governor signed a few weeks ago is horrific. As a child is exiting the womb and completely able to live, we'll slice their skull and suck their brains out and break all their bones to pull them out of the mother's body. That's partial birth abortion. I watched an interesting debate, and I'm almost done, but an interesting debate recently between a college activist for abortion and just a very good middle-aged African-American woman. And they were debating abortion, and they were just, all the crowd was hooting her down. The college students were hooting her down. Had signs up. And all she did was a Socratic method. She just asked them questions. So she said, when is it okay? Up until when? Do you only abort when a child is viable? No, you can abort up to the moment of a birth. And she said, what about viability? And the person, the college girl said, well, yeah, you can abort until they're viable or the time of birth. Then she said this. So how long after a child is born until it's viable? She said, because I have three children. And she said, let me tell you something, moms, you're going to appreciate this. The day they were born, they were not able to live without me. If you'd have just set them out in a rock, they wouldn't have survived. If you'd have just set them in a crib, they wouldn't have survived. So she said, do you realize by your way of thinking, you can take a child's life as late as 5 and 6 years of age? And you should have seen all the other young people. They just were dumbfounded. I mean, it went silent. Because she just asked them questions about the foolishness and the ridiculousness of taking the lives of image bearers of God. Where did I come from? I'm a unique creation of God. You are a unique creation of God. You're made the way God wants you to be. Why? So that I can be to His glory, the visible manifestation of His essence. My job, my purpose in life, from the moment my first breath till my last breath, is to be the visible manifestation of the essence of God. That is the definition of glory. I am to be the visible. Everything I do is to reflect His holiness, His righteousness, His mercy, His forgiveness, His love, His grace. I am to be the visible. I live for the glory of God. Go to Ephesians 1. Three times in Ephesians 1, we are to be to the praise of His glory. We are to be to the praise of His glory. We are to be to the praise of His glory. That's why I'm here. I am not here to get all I can all I get, and then sit on the lid. That is not my purpose for life. My purpose in life is not to have great kids so everybody will go, wow, you're a great parent. That's not my purpose in life. My purpose in life to have great kids and great grandkids is so that people will look at them and say, wow, they have a great God. And where am I going? To heaven so that I can enjoy Him forever. This is one of the great philosophical answers. Where did you come from? What are you doing here? Where are you going? And Jesus Christ looks at Pilate when Pilate probably sarcastically says, what is truth? And He looks at him and He says, I was trying to get you there. And you walked away. You walked away. We'll stop right there for this morning. We have two more trials. We have a trial with Herod, and then we have a trial back with Pilate where Pilate will condemn him. I trust as we're taking our steps through this, as I make some applications about truth and purpose in life and encouraging you that God's goal for you is conformity to His Son's image, and He will use comfort and discomfort to achieve that purpose. Because sometimes we think bad equals discomfort and good equals comfort. And that's not true. God is always good to a believer, even in discomfort. Because He's going to use the discomfort to produce Christ's image in